Hello and welcome to Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a home for people passionate about positive impact. What does it take to create a truly equitable healthcare system? From entrepreneurs to investors to community workers from across the globe, this season we're speaking to the people aligning capital and technology to find the answer. This episode is produced in partnership with the Johnson & Johnson Center for Health Worker Innovation as part of a series investigating the trends, challenges, and opportunities in the global healthcare sector. My guest today is Dr. Laura Satchell, co-founder and executive director of WeCare Solar. Laura holds an MD from the University of California, San Francisco, an MPH in maternal and child health, and has just completed her doctorate in public health at the University of California, Berkeley. After working as an obstetrician and gynecologist for 14 years, Laura co-founded WeCare Solar to bring simple solar electric solutions to maternal and child healthcare in regions without reliable electricity. The WeCare Solar Suitcase, a compact solar energy system, won the 2019 Edison Innovation Award and was selected by Time Magazine as one of the best inventions of 2019. In 2018, WeCare Solar launched the International Light Every Birth Initiative to ensure every woman can access safe childbirth services, prioritizing African countries with the highest rate of maternal mortality. For her work with WeCare Solar, Laura has received numerous prestigious awards. Laura, it's a great privilege to be speaking to you today. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Paul.
So Laura, I'd like to ask an initial question. Can you define energy poverty and tell us how it intersects with maternal mortality?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So energy poverty, most simply, is a lack of access to modern energy services. Worldwide, about 1 in 7 people lack electricity. And what that means is, rather than being able to flip on a light switch or use an electronic device, they rely on very inferior sources of lighting, most commonly candles, kerosene lanterns. Maybe they have a diesel fuel generator, but that may not work very well. And generally, they don't have the ability to use electricity or bright lights. Where that intersects with maternal mortality is that within the, it's almost 1 billion people who don't have electricity, and that's mostly in sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia. So within these areas are health facilities that are very reliant on electricity and on lighting. And in the health facilities that don't have electricity, it means that health workers are forced to compromise the kind of care they can provide because they cannot see and they cannot use devices that are very important for life-saving maneuvers. We see that in countries with the highest rates of maternal mortality are very often the same countries that have energy poverty, that don't have access to modern electricity. And so in those countries, health facilities are struggling to try and provide very basic and also very comprehensive emergency obstetric care. Some of the most common reasons for maternal mortality are things like hemorrhage, infection, a condition called eclampsia, where you have high blood pressure that leads to convulsions, obstructed labor, which means the baby can't fit through the birth canal and a cesarean section is needed. And the emergency procedures that are required to save lives require bright lights, they require machinery. If you think about doing a cesarean section, there's quite a lot of machines that depend on electricity for that. So in countries with energy poverty, health workers basically cannot perform life-saving care and lives are being lost.
So you were studying at UC Berkeley before founding WeCare Solar. And I understand you had a really specific experience in Nigeria that led you to launch this not-for-profit organization. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I was an obstetrician for about 14 years before deciding to go back to school and study public health care. And I was really interested in the fact that globally at that time, about 500,000 women died every year from complications of pregnancy and childbirth. And to put that in perspective, that would be the same as 2 747 jets crashing to the ground every day filled with pregnant women. I had always assumed pregnancy was a real joyous event. That's part of the reason I loved being an obstetrician. But when I learned that maternal mortality was so prevalent worldwide, I really wanted to try and study ways to try and lower maternal mortality. At that time, Nigeria accounted for 2% of the world population, but 11% of all maternal deaths. And UC Berkeley, where I was studying, was doing a program in collaboration with a university in northern Nigeria to try and research ways to lower maternal mortality. And specifically, I was asked to go into a state hospital just to observe what was happening in the hospital. We know that maternal mortality is an aggregate of many, many different factors. And in countries that are quite impoverished, many women will try and deliver at home. And only if they have complications do they go to a hospital. And what we found from some of the preliminary research in that program was that even when women got to hospitals, they might not get life-saving care. So I was invited to do medical anthropology and literally do an ethnography, sitting observing what was happening in the hospital. And I had anticipated that it would be quite different from the hospitals I was used to in the United States. I didn't think they'd have as many people or maybe some of the advanced machinery. But it never occurred to me that a hospital would be without reliable electricity. So imagine for a moment what that meant. It meant that midwives were working by candlelight, that nurses couldn't start intravenous lines because they didn't have enough visualization. It meant that surgeries might be delayed until the next day when there was either sunlight or they could use the ambient light of windows to do procedures. It meant that procedures were canceled. And on one occasion, I saw a woman that I know was having something called a uterine rupture. She had actually started bleeding internally. She was barely able to have a blood pressure. She came to the door of the hospital, but because we were in darkness, the midwife sent her back into the darkness because they could not provide care. So I began to see time after time how women and newborns were not getting life-saving care. There was one night in particular where I was in the labor room and there was no light whatsoever, and a woman there had a condition that was called eclampsia. She was having seizures. She no longer had good blood flow to her lungs, to her liver, to her kidneys. Her urine was no longer being made because her kidneys had shut down. She wasn't getting good blood flow to the uterus. In my hospital in the United States, she would have been in an intensive care unit. And here she was in a place where we couldn't even see her. And it was somewhat of a chamber of horrors to me. I said, why am I here right now? Why am I here bearing witness to these women who are dying in silence? And I thought, maybe I'm here to help tell their story. As an obstetrician, as someone that was being trained in public health, I had no idea that electricity was this much of a problem. And maybe I'm here to tell their story. And so I began to write letters, first to my family, then to other people that were interested, just describing the conditions that I was seeing. And this led to a subsequent innovation.
I'd love to hear about that innovation. As I understand, you out of this developed the solar suitcase. Tell us what that is and how it works.
Well, the solar suitcase is a compact solar electric system that's been developed specifically for maternal health care. And when I was writing letters back home, the most important recipient was my husband, Hal Aronson, who at that time was teaching solar energy to students in California. And as I described the electricity challenges I was facing, he immediately thought of solar electricity as an appropriate technology. And he designed a solar electric system that would address the main areas of the hospital related to maternal mortality. We brought in a solar electric system for the labor room, for the operating theater, and also for the laboratory to supply electricity to a solar-powered blood bank so that women who were hemorrhaging could get immediate blood transfusions. We ended up fundraising and actually completing this project over the next several months, and we saw a 70% drop in maternal deaths the next year at the hospital, as well as a 16% increase in admissions. At that time, there was no organization and there was no sort of new innovative technology. But one of the things that happened was that surrounding health centers began coming to meet me when I was going back to Nigeria saying, Why are you only helping the hospital? We're in the dark as well. And we began to realize that we needed a solar electric system that could scale and that was designed to target maternal and newborn mortality. And so we developed something that's called a solar suitcase. It's a compact solar electric system that has medical quality lighting. It has power for communication devices so that people in need of assembling a team of, let's say, doctors and surgeons to be able to try and address emergencies could be assembled quickly. And it also has power for medical devices such as a fetal heart rate monitor to listen to a baby's heartbeat during labor and determine which babies are most at risk and might need a cesarean section or another type of intervention. My husband had developed this small prototype for me to show my colleagues in Nigeria before we had done the large solar installation. And it was actually that prototype that eventually evolved into a purposeful solar electric system that could fit in my suitcase. Initially, when we had brought in that first prototype, I was telling him, you need to make something very easy for me to use that I can sneak through customs. So I want you to make a system that would fit in my suitcase. And so that's how we ended up with the suitcase size system. Each time I would go back to Nigeria, we would create a small solar electric system that I could pack and bring with me. And I would bring these to different health centers that were not far from the large hospital where I was still continuing my studies. Unbeknownst to me, someone in the New York Times, Nicholas Kristof, actually wrote about what we were doing. And overnight, we began to get requests for solar suitcases from around the world. And that was how I learned that the issue of energy poverty was not unique to northern Nigeria. It's actually an issue that affects health workers worldwide.
So this is a classic story of social entrepreneurship. A gifted person arrives and sees a problem, is determined to address it, hacks a solution, and then seeks to scale it. So tell us how your company has grown since its inception and a little bit about the challenges that you've encountered as you've gone along the way.
Sure. So in those early days, we had a complete volunteer operation, and our house was literally turned into a solar suitcase factory. Neighbors would donate suitcases. We would do fundraisers to try and get bits of equipment. We would have an assembly line in the backyard where volunteers would come, and we would literally put these together. And we didn't have a system at that time as to who should get the solar suitcases, other than if somebody wrote to me wanting one and I could find someone to bring them a suitcase, we would try and make those connections. So people would come to the house, I would give them a solar suitcase and some training, and they would literally carry it to the health center in whatever part of the world they were traveling. What we've done over time is really move from that very ad hoc type of approach to a much more systemic approach. And we began to work in partnership with institutions that were addressing maternal and child health care, but didn't have an electricity solution. So we would work with groups like JAPIGO, Pathfinder, Save the Children, UNICEF, UNFPA, organizations that had many interventions that were addressing the issues in maternal and child health care. Again, they didn't have the energy access. And then what we did was we also realized that the technology was only one piece of the equation. We needed to create a system to train people first to use the equipment appropriately, but actually, as the programs grew, train people to actually do installations themselves. And we developed something called the Women's Solar Ambassador Program in about 2012, where we brought women to our home in Berkeley and trained them in some of the basics of maternal health care, the basics of solar energy, and then how to lead training programs so that people in their own countries could actually lead the installation process. And so then we developed programs that were like a two-week training program where people would learn about safety skills, how do you get on a roof, how to use power tools, how do you go into a labor room and decide where to put lights, where to put the solar electric system. The solar suitcase, I should mention, doubles as a cabinet. So that case, which is a hard yellow rugged case, doubles as a cabinet that you can put onto a wall so it becomes a permanent installation. The solar panels get permanently installed on the ceiling, and then we actually try and locate lights in an area that makes them most useful for midwives and other health workers that are using them. At that point, we were working mostly at the district level. So many of these partners might be doing programs that would address dozens of health centers within a certain district of a country. But then what we found by doing our research was sometimes women were actually traveling far from their own villages to try and get to the health center that had light. And we realized as a matter of equity that really all women should have the right to safe childbirth in a well-lit health center. And so we began to wonder whether or not we could actually do countrywide programs. And so in 2018, we launched this initiative that's called Light Every Birth, which is really around three fundamental beliefs. One, every woman has the right to safe childbirth. Two, every health center is entitled to reliable electricity. And three, solar energy offers an immediate and sustainable solution to this global problem. And just as we have the sustainable development goals that are aiming to eradicate energy poverty by 2030 and significantly lower rates of maternal and newborn mortality, we believe that healthcare institutions should be front and center in this global quest for equity. And so Light Every Birth is saying that we need to ensure that every maternal health facility has reliable lighting so that health workers are able to save lives. So to do that, we then needed to start working with governments. And so we've developed government partnerships. For our initial part of our work, we've really strategically chosen countries that have the highest rates of maternal mortality and very low rates of energy access. And our first Light Every Birth countries are Liberia, Uganda, Sierra Leone, and Zimbabwe. And I'm very pleased to say that for Light Every Birth Liberia, we actually have reached every public health facility that was in need of lighting for safe childbirth. So we're showing that when you work in partnership with governments, with UN agencies, with institutional partners, other types of NGOs, when you provide local capacity, you actually can reach every health facility in a country. So we're showing that it's feasible and possible to do this.
So I want to ask a question about your theater of operations, because obviously you were very drawn to assist people in developing economies with fragile or nascent healthcare systems. But this disparate level of maternal safety and higher levels of maternal mortality occur within developed countries as well. So I want to ask just a preliminary question. Why do you think that is, and what steps do you think we should be taking to address this?
So it is true that there are disparities worldwide. In the United States, Black women are dying at 3 to 4 times the rate of white women. And I think there's a number of root causes for this. One of them has to do with the quality of care and whether all women are able to access quality of care. But the other thing that we're seeing, and I think the Black Lives Matter has been doing a very good job of trying to raise this, in addition to the quality of care, though, we need to look at some of the institutional factors that lead to inequities to begin with. And we've seen through the Black Lives Matter movement that there are racial inequities and that women of color in this country have much higher rates of stress. There's much higher rates of racism. And we see something that's called weathering, where literally their bodies are aging at a different rate than some of their white counterparts because of a lot of the institutional factors that affect educational opportunities, that affect economic opportunities, that affect their lives on a daily basis. Even in the United States, Black women with a college education are dying at higher rates than their white counterparts because of some of this weathering, because of some of the racism factors. They have higher rates of blood pressure. They have higher rates of obesity. So until we really start looking at the underpinnings of some of these racial inequities, I don't think that we're going to be able to fully address the types of racial disparities that you were talking about.
So let me ask you how COVID-19 and this pandemic has affected your focus with We Care Solar. What new challenges are healthcare workers experiencing on the ground in the countries where you are most active?
So when we think about COVID-19, we're thinking now about an infectious disease. And when we think about health workers and what they need, we are all very aware that health workers need PPE. I'm sure that you're hearing it in the United Kingdom. It's certainly true in the United States. In countries where energy access is a problem, health workers fail to have one of the most basic aspects of preventing infection, which is light. How are you able to prevent yourself from getting infected if you can't even see what you're doing? How are you able to prevent cross-contamination? So as one of the health officers at the Ministry of Health in Zimbabwe told me, he said light is part of PPE. In sub-Saharan Africa, where we work, we are now starting to see that COVID is spreading to these areas. And some of the people who previously lived in cities are now going into rural areas. And so that's putting extra stressors on some of these rural health centers that may not have PPE, that may not have good quality light. Some of the people I've spoken to have told me that they actually have had an increase of patients. However, over time, what we expect to see is actually a decrease in patients because patients become fearful of going to health centers when they think that an infection, that they may be exposing themselves to infection. So we saw this with Ebola. We saw that a lot of women were afraid to go to health centers. They ended up staying at home. They did not get skilled care. And it's estimated that as many women died from complications of pregnancy from not getting skilled care at home as people who died directly from Ebola who were pregnant. And we are very worried about this from COVID as well, that people will be fearful of going to the health centers. The health workers don't want to go, particularly if they don't have light. Patients don't want to go. And so we are actually seeing that our programs are more important than ever. In order to create resilience in the health centers, we absolutely need to make sure that they have electricity and that they're equipped with the rest of PPE so that they can provide life-saving care.
So Laura, I'd like to ask you a question about how hard it is to do this alone and the myth that it only takes one person to tackle these. I'm sure you have an incredibly dedicated team of people around you who makes this entire endeavor possible. Tell us a little bit about them.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when Hal, my husband, and I started this, neither of us had ever run an organization. We knew nothing about business. We knew nothing about international development. And we were really driven by just our passion of wanting to try and help to electrify first one hospital and then a few. So we really surrounded ourselves with people that did understand these other things. We brought in people that had skills in business, people that had skills in engineering, people who had skills in international development. And right now we have a core team of 12 wonderful people in the United States, as well as people working in the countries in which we serve. We have 5 African staff members who are based in the countries where we are doing Light Every Birth. And they each bring their own level of expertise. You know, you need to have people that know how to do finance and know how to collect data and do research and know how to implement programs. And then we have our education staff. And it really takes a family working together, and in our case, a fairly lean and very active team, to make this type of thing possible.
I know that WeCare Solar has a strong focus on gender inclusivity across the organization. And so can you tell us a little bit about your Women's Solar Ambassador Program and how your women engineers in particular are breaking stereotypes?
So when we started doing work in Africa, I didn't have any women solar ambassadors. I had male colleagues that would come with me, and I realized that it was actually difficult. We'd be going into labor and delivery rooms to do solar installations while women were literally in labor. And so it became quite uncomfortable. There was one time in Nigeria where the team had to wait while I actually helped with 5 subsequent deliveries before it was okay for them to enter the rooms. So in one way, it was actually a logistical issue. How do we get solar installers that can come in? In another way, though, we really wanted to change the model of who it was that was leading the solar energy revolution. And why shouldn't women be change makers as well as the beneficiaries of our program? And so we began to train women how to use solar electric equipment. And then some of the women in Africa said, well, why can't we do the installations as well? And so we began getting them onto the rooftops and building those skills. So the Solar Ambassador Program was a way to formalize a process that really began to happen informally. And the idea is that these women are now training technicians in the countries in which we're working. Very often, these are some of the cold chain technicians. Those are the people that are actually ensuring that vaccine refrigeration is working well in different health centers throughout a country. These cold chain technicians visit the health centers, and so we've been able to empower them to understand how to do installations and how to maintain equipment over time. We've also been training now solar companies and inviting them to bring more women into the fold. And in fact, we've actually stimulated in some cases groups of women who are now working together to have women's groups of solar installers. For example, there's a group in Liberia that was started by a woman that went through one of our programs. Basically, we believe that women should be part of the clean energy revolution, and they have been traditionally very much underrepresented. And so we're trying to achieve greater gender equity by showing that women can actually be training other people to do this and modeling this through our programs.
So one of the challenges in intervening where there are such obvious deficiencies and shortages is that you can feel as though you're plugging holes or band-aiding broken systems. And so I guess I wanted to ask you a broader question about what you've learned from your work with WeCare Solar and in your engagement with fellow healthcare workers across the continent, in Africa in particular, about how you build resilient, sustainable, equitable healthcare systems as a whole.
What a great question, Paul. You know, you're absolutely right that it can feel very overwhelming when you look at all the problems in a health facility. I had talked to you about my early work in Nigeria, and I focused on the electricity issue, but there were many issues. There were issues of not having enough staff people. There were issues of not having clear protocols, of not having running water, of not having enough equipment to actually do standard of care all the time. And it is true that you can look at everything at once and say, why even bother? There's too many problems. However, what I've really learned is that if you can do one thing and do it well, the key is that we really need to partner with others. As an obstetrician, it seems quite funny that I'm leading an organization focused on solar energy. I understand that there needs to be many interventions to improve maternal health care. And one thing I like to say is, our job is not just to shine a light on bad care, but one thing that we've been doing is we work with other groups that are working on educating midwives and getting other pieces of equipment. And it's really by creating interlinkages between many groups working together that I do think that we can create systemic change. So there is one of the SDGs that talks about partnerships, and maybe that's not emphasized enough. I think partnerships is really, really key. And becoming very good in whatever domain is your area of expertise and offering that as part of a more integrated, interlinked solution is really the way that we're going to have systemic change.
So to that end, you launched We Share Solar to train young people to become the solar solutionaries of the future. And so can you tell us a little more about that program and why education in this area is so important to you?
So I think I mentioned at the very beginning that my husband was actually teaching young people in California about solar electricity right at the time when I was first doing my research in Nigeria. And one of the things that I think is one of our core values is that we really want to empower people to envision a better future and to have a sense of agency and a sense of creating change themselves. And we have seen the power of innovation when it comes to creating even a very modest amount of electricity. A solar suitcase does not power an entire hospital, but it looks at what are the most essential needs for health workers. And we wanted to give young people the opportunity to also say, how would you like to use solar electricity? What are the ways that you can be involved? And so one of the things that also was happening in our early years is that as people heard about solar for healthcare, we would get a lot of requests from schools, orphanages, and other community institutions that also needed solar electricity. And we began to think that it would be wonderful to pair student education, the work that Hal had been doing in student education, with these needs of youth in other countries to have electricity. Because in addition to all the health centers that don't have electricity, there are a lot of schools that don't have light, that don't have electricity. And so the We Share Solar program teaches young people about the issues of energy poverty, teaches them about the SDGs, teaches them about solar electricity, and then allows them to build solar electric systems. We have a specialized kit, a solar suitcase kit, that they then put together and then they donate to schools that don't have reliable electricity. And we're creating intercultural linkages so that students, for example, in the United States or in the UK, can be in contact with their counterparts in other countries and understanding that they can work together to try and solve problems. More recently, we've been bringing the We Share solution actually to the students in Africa themselves, both in programs in Uganda and in Kenya, because ultimately we want to give young people the tools, as I said, to solve the problems that they face, to have agency within their own communities, and to really work towards, you know, improving global outcomes. And that's only going to happen if we really give them the skills and the tools and ignite a passion inside them to do the same kinds of things that we've been doing at We Care Solar.
So as a person who has been this wildly successful change agent in the world of healthcare and healthcare systems, and you've seen so much dysfunction and inequity, what one change would you like to see to ameliorate or improve the system as a whole?
Well, it's really hard to choose just one, but I definitely believe in universal health care. And furthermore, I think that we need to have high quality care and also compassionate care. In a lot of the countries in which I work, patients are actually chastised very often when they come in for care, and they may end up, instead of being reinforced in a positive way for coming in, they may be scolded for coming too late or not having done some of the right things during their pregnancies. So I would like to see healthcare workers have the resources they need so that they can feel good about themselves and actually embrace patients who come in so that people are interested in actually coming in to access quality healthcare.
You've described so many difficult scenes, so much unnecessary and often tragic loss of life. And in that, I should imagine it must be difficult to remain optimistic. So what is it that gives you inspiration and gives you hope when you've chosen to work in such a difficult setting?
Paul, I realize a real failure that I have not talked about all the incredibly successful outcomes that have happened. I haven't talked to you about what it means to a health worker who actually receives a solar suitcase and how she feels empowered, how it boosts her morale, how it boosts her confidence, how she says, wow, it's like daytime at night right now. I can see more patients. I can take care of more patients. I just finished a dissertation reviewing over 1,000 interviews with health workers before and then about 500 after who have received solar suitcases. And I'm overwhelmed with positivity. What's amazing to me is that these health workers, who are in my mind the true heroes of this story, that they've been going to work night after night when they haven't even had electricity. And then you give them bright lights and they are so empowered. They're so excited. It has changed the way they view themselves, their health centers, and how the community views the health centers. And I'll give you just one example of what even one solar suitcase can do. There's a doctor in the DR Congo who requested a solar suitcase a few years ago. His name is Dr. Jacques Sebisaho. He was visiting New York. He asked if we could send him one on his way back. And I said, sure, taught him over Skype how to use it. And then I said, please call me as soon as you get to the DR Congo. I barely taught you how to use this. I want to give you more help. I didn't hear from him for 5 weeks. When he called, he said, I'm so sorry I didn't call right away. The day I arrived at my clinic, which was on the island of Ijwi, where there was no electricity at all, he said, the day I arrived, I helped a woman with twins. He said, but the next day there was an outbreak of cholera. And for the next 30 days, I took care of 122 mothers, fathers, and children with this deadly disease. He said, in the past, I used to lose 50% of these patients with cholera. 80% of the deaths happened at night. He said, with the solar suitcase, nobody died. He said, we are witnessing what light means in communities where night means death to those in need of emergency care after the sun goes down. Paul, I have so many stories I could share with you that do give me hope, that show that even a small change in a system can actually lead to a ripple of other changes. And so, if anything, I would say this work is some of the most inspiring things I've ever done, that in the face of, you know, so much deprivation in these systems, that you have people that are health heroes willing to do the work. And just with very small interventions, they are completely empowered and it can transform care.
So, Laura, we're having this conversation in the midst of a once in a century or even more consequential than that pandemic. And things that people hitherto took for granted, like safety and like health and like being able to be engaged with people in close human contact, are now very much in question. But I think a corollary of that is that there are a whole generation of people who are wanting to make a positive impact as you have in the sphere of healthcare. And so what advice would you give to a person who said, I want to embark on a new career or change my existing career in order to make the kind of contribution that you have? What should they do?
Well, I really hope that with this pandemic, that it has really allowed all of us to be more empathetic and really understand some of the barriers that face our brothers and sisters in other countries. And I would say for someone who's embarking on a new career, the first thing is just to identify what's a problem that you care about. What is something that you feel passionate about? Because this work is very hard, as you know, Paul. I may be making it sound like it was an easy journey, but there were a lot of challenges along the way to get here. So you need to have a deep sense of caring about the issue. And then the next step is to say, what can I learn and understand from the people who are most affected about this problem? I think what really has guided us from the very beginning is the fact that I went and spent time observing care in a completely different system to my own. I tried to basically step into the shoes of other people and both talk to them to interview them, but also experience what things were like from their perspective. And that allowed me to see something in a very different way than I had seen before. So I would say really trying to understand a problem, see whether you can resonate with it quickly, and then don't feel like you need to solve everything. If someone had told me in the beginning, gee, you're going to be starting an international nonprofit, I would have been so scared and overwhelmed. I don't know if I would have taken the next step. You only need to take care of one little thing, one problem in front of you. And once you solve that problem, you'll get the opportunity to see if you should solve the next problem or other types of problem. Those will become evident. So I would say start small. Tiny little steps can add up and lead to very big change. But you don't need to see the whole picture at the beginning. You just need to start with that very first step.
Laura, that's extraordinarily wise advice. And I think on behalf of everybody who is fighting for a more just, a more equitable, a more humane, and a more decent world, I'd like to offer a huge vote of thanks to you and to all the work that you've done on behalf of social entrepreneurs, on behalf of women, and behalf of all the people who rely on women as both bedrocks of our civilization and also as the founders of life. So thank you so very much.
Thank you, Paul. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you.
Thank you for listening to Conduit Conversations. Feel free to subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. To learn more about the Johnson & Johnson Center for Health Worker Innovation, please visit chwy.jnj.com. Once more, chwy.jnj.com. And for more information on The Conduit and our community of changemakers, please visit theconduit.com.